From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a personal history of rap music from the co-founder of rap's longest-running group. We'll talk with Daryl McDaniels of Run DMC. It was the first rap group to earn a gold record. We'll talk about how lyrics and performing styles have changed and how the amount of money at stake and the violence have increased. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the first volume of a new biography of Yates. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. At least five people were killed and 100 injured as a powerful cyclone smashed into the coast of Bangladesh today. Officials there say the death toll is likely to go much higher. Thousands of houses were demolished by the storm. The Pentagon will officially release its review of strategy, weapons, and force structure today. The Quadrennial Defense Review, as it's called, calls for only modest reductions in personnel and infrastructure and proposes a continued ability to fight two major regional conflicts nearly simultaneously. NPR's Pentagon correspondent Martha Raddatz reports.
The two-war capability is at the center of the review, just as it was in the bottom-up review completed 4 years ago. Secretary of Defense William Cohen believes that despite the end of the Cold War, it is a capability that the Defense Department must maintain. The review also calls for reducing military personnel by about 100,000. Currently, the active duty force is about 1,400,000, and reservists number 900,000. The most controversial part of the review may be the proposal for closing down or consolidating some domestic military bases, a move that may face opposition in Congress. The savings, says Cohen, will be used in the weapons modernization budget, which Cohen says is in the red by about $15 billion. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
The Supreme Court will decide on the constitutionality of using lie detector results at criminal trials. Critics say a total ban on the admissibility of lie detector results violates some defendants' rights. The review stems from the California case of a court-martialed airman in which the nation's highest military court threw out such a flat ban as unconstitutional. Mobutu Sese Seko is believed to be in Togo now. Sources in the Togolese government say the deposed president of Zaire is resting at the home of Togo's dictator. Mobutu was forced out of his country palace by rebels yesterday. The sources say Mobutu will not stay in Togo more than a few days. It's not clear where he will end up. In the newly named Democratic Republic of Congo, self-proclaimed President Laurent Kabila is expected to announce his new government tomorrow. NPR's Jennifer Ludden is in Kinshasa.
I'm told, meeting this afternoon with director generals of the different state ministries to try and give them an idea of any changes they might announce. They clearly want people to continue to go back to business as usual. They're not quite sure how to proceed, so it's a real waiting period.
NPR's Jennifer Ludden reporting from Kinshasa. The FBI's crime lab comes under more scrutiny today at the Oklahoma City bombing trial. FBI scientist Ronald Kennedy is on the witness stand for cross-examination. Lawyers for Timothy McVeigh claim the lab's tests on some key evidence in the case are unreliable. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 9 points in light trading, the Nasdaq down 4. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, the stock market is mixed today in a narrow trading range. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
Investors are unwilling to place big bets before tomorrow's meeting of the Federal Reserve's Policy Committee. Most analysts say the chances of an increase in interest rates as a preemptive move against higher inflation are too close to call. International oil stocks are higher on speculation that Mobil and Amoco plan to combine their refining operations. And tobacco shares are benefiting from reports of an agreement on the limitation of liability for tobacco companies in lawsuits from smokers. On the other hand, computer-related issues are out of favor in today's trading. I'm Doug Krisner.
The E.W. Scripps Company says it will pay about $625 million for the media operations of Hartke Hanks Communications. The deal includes 6 daily newspapers, 25 other publications, and a TV and radio station. Hartke Hanks is the largest supplier of free shopping guides in the United States. Britain has announced it will not only ban all cigarette advertising, but also bar tobacco companies from sponsoring sporting events. Prime Minister Tony Blair's government had promised earlier to ban tobacco ads, but the comments today by the country's new health secretary were the first indication that it will also bar sports sponsorship. The legislation is still being drafted, but Blair has such a huge majority in the House of Commons that it's certain to pass. American Express Company has signed golfer Tiger Woods to a multi-million dollar deal under which he will be a spokesman for the company. It is the third major endorsement contract for Woods. Terms of the deal are said to include $30 million over a 5-year period. Woods just turned pro last year. This is NPR.
Support for National Public Radio comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation for reporting on disadvantaged youth and families, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The murders of rap stars Tupac Shakur and Biggie Smalls have drawn attention to the violence within the rap world. My guest, Daryl McDaniels, has seen the changes in rap music and hip-hop culture through the 80s and 90s. He's a co-founder of rap's longest-running group, Run DMC. We invited him to talk with us about some of the changes he's seen and to give us a personal history of rap. Run DMC had its first hit back in 1983. It's like that. In 84, they became the first rappers to earn a gold album. The next year, they were the first to earn a platinum. They were the first rap group to have their videos played on MTV and the first to appear on the cover of Rolling Stone. Co-founder Joseph Simmons, the Run in Run DMC, is the brother of Russell Simmons, the founder of Def Jam Productions, which has produced hip-hop concerts, films, and comedy jams. Before we meet Daryl McDaniels, here he is on Sucker MC, the B-side of their first record, It's Like That.
I'm DMC, in the place to be. I go to St. John's University, and since kindergarten I acquired the knowledge. And after 12th grade I went straight to college. I'm light skinned, I live in Queens, and I love eating chicken and collard greens. I dress to kill, I love the style. I'm an MC, you know who's versatile. Say I got good credit in your regards. Got my name, not numbers on my credit cards. I go uptown, I come back home for food, me, myself, and my microphone. All my rhymes are
Daryl McDaniels, welcome to Fresh Air. How do you think the rap world is being changed by the murders of Tupac and Biggie Smalls?
Well, I think there's a greater awareness of really what's going on in society and inside the neighborhoods that the rappers come from. It seems like all the violence and the drugs and the sex and just all the negative stuff that most of the rappers are trying to get away from is now following them into their careers, into their places of business, and into their homes. And I think it's a great awareness now that it's really a problem out there, not just among the rappers, but within our neighborhoods and the streets that we come from.
Are rap performers now more afraid, more security conscious?
Yes, definitely. A couple of rappers now have bulletproof vests, now higher security, now higher off-duty police officers. A couple of the rappers ride around in bulletproof vehicles. So I think there's a lot of worry out there among the rappers, and not just the rappers, also a lot of the R&B singers and the singers in general, and a lot of sports people.
What about you? Have you heightened your security?
No, I haven't. Run DMC has a reputation of being well-liked, and because we relate so well with the community, black, white, Puerto Rican, Japan, European, whatever, you know, I can go anywhere and not worry.
What are your theories about the murders?
Well, I think what we have here is when the media hyped up the East Coast, West Coast beef, so-called beef, I think it's sort of like having high school A and high school B. And both of these high schools are going to the championship game at the end of the week. Now, what you have here is fans of high school A and fans of high school B meeting each other or confronting each other, maybe at the mall, at the movie theater. And a lot of the things that the rappers are saying on their records, the people who represent the neighborhoods that the rappers come from tend to take these things seriously. So you get high school A saying, we're the best, and high school B saying, no, we're the best. And then it's actually, when it used to be lyrical, rhyme for rhyme in a battle, now it's become physical. Rap has become so materialistic. So I think for the murders, you have fans who said, okay, Tupac was shot this way. Somebody could have just seen Biggie Smalls. I mean, this is just my theory on it, and said, oh, I'm going to revenge Tupac, and bang, 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 West Coast, we're number one, or whatever. That's the way I look at it.
Do you think it's fair to make connections between the glorification of gangbanging in rap lyrics and the shooting of rappers?
Well, the only connection there actually is whether or not the rappers were rapping about these things, or it was happening to the rappers who are the celebrities of the hood. This is going on in the hood all day. I mean, Tupac Shakur and Biggie Smalls are just examples of Tupac and Biggie dying in our neighborhood every day. Even where I come from, I mean, so many of my friends have died by senseless violence. I mean, probably in the last 15 years, I know 20 people that I grew up with that died by, you know, gunshots, drive-bys and just stupid, you know, arguments and pulling out guns and bang, bang. And, you know, it's really scary. If they ain't dying, they're in jail. So the things that the rappers are rapping about are things that they experience. It just seems that most of the rappers now making the records all are rapping about the same thing. So it seems like this is all that there is to rap. But there's another positive side of rap that people don't talk about.
Talk about that.
Well, you have groups like LL Cool J, Run DMC, Public Enemy, KRS-One, A Tribe Called Quest, The Fugees, and these are groups that just make music and make good songs. These are groups that do a lot of things for their communities. These are groups that have positive images. These are groups that also sell a lot of records. Even though the so-called gangster rap sells millions of records, The Fugees sold millions of records, LL Cool J sold millions of records, but nobody want to talk about the good things. And within rap music, there's a lot of positive rap records being made, and there's a lot of positive rap groups that are very successful. But it seems more interesting to talk about the gangster rappers that are making all this money, that are dominating the industry right now.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Daryl McDaniels. He's the DMC in Run DMC, which is, I think, just about the longest-running rap group performing today. Let's talk about the history of Run DMC, which spans a lot of the history of rap. But before we do, I had asked you before what you prefer that I call you, and you have a great rhyme that answers that question. Would you just do that rhyme for us?
Yeah. Well, you can call me Daryl, you can call me D, you can call me Daryl Mac, or you can call me DMC. People always ask me, what does my name mean? D's for never dirty, MC for mostly clean. But sometimes I tell them, when certain people ask, that DMC means that Daryl makes cash.
That's good. How did you first hear rap?
Wow, that's a good question. The first time I ever heard rap was back in 1970, I think it was either 76 or 78. There was a radio show. It was like an underground radio show, and the disc jockey's name was Eddie Chiba. And the station was in New York. It was WFUV. And that was the first time I ever heard rap. He had a rhyme where he said, when you mess around in New York town, you go down with the disco Chiba clown. You go down, go down, go down, go down, you go down. You know, it was really simple. But the first time I ever heard rap was back in 76 or 78 on WFUV DJ Eddie Chiba.
Now, what made you think, I want to do that?
Well, when I first started out, I wanted to be a DJ. I really liked the scratching and the quick mixing and, you know, doing the DJ thing, spinning records and mixing records back and forth. And then out of, you know, listening to DJs and studying Grandmaster Flash, I started hearing, you know, tapes of DJ Starsky and Melly Mel and Kumo D and the Treacherous Three. And something just sparked in me where I wanted to become a vocalist and express myself on the microphone.
So did you sing before you started rhyming?
No, I didn't. I started rhyming first.
And what were your very early rhymes like?
Oh, well, my very early rhymes were, you know, basically simple, talking about I had the best rhymes, nobody had more rhymes than me, my DJ was the best DJ, we had the loudest sound system, you know, it was simple stuff like C to an apple, apple to a core, I am the man with the rhymes galore, rock a rhyme for me, rock a rhyme for you, and everybody catch the boogaloo flu. Hollis, Queens is where I'm from, don't be stupid, don't be so dumb. So it's basically boasting about my neighborhood, me being the best MC and nobody can take me out.
Speaking of your neighborhood, you're from Hollis, Queens.
Yes.
In New York, and the two other members of Run DMC are from the same neighborhood, I think.
Yes.
And you went to school together, right? You knew each other before you were a group.
Yeah, definitely. We all lived in five blocks of each other. We went to elementary and high school and college together.
So when did you actually form Run DMC? Where were you in your school years?
Well, me and Run first started rhyming and DJing together in my basement. I actually taught Run how to DJ. He was rapping first, then I taught him how to DJ, how to do the quick mix and how to spin records back and how to blend two of the same records together. So Run and DMC was like formed back in around 1980. We started DJing in my basement, and then when he got... he got better equipment to me for Christmas, so we started DJing in his attic. So I would say Run DMC was formed right then. And then as the group, it was 1982 when we put together It's Like That and That's the Way It Is as Sucker MCs, which was our first single. And then we needed a DJ, and that's when we got Jam Master Jay, who was the neighborhood DJ. He was like the best DJ in the neighborhood. Jay would set up his equipment in the park, and he'd plug it in into the light post, and then we would play until a cops would come and stop us. So actually, we came together as a professional group in 1982.
And were you in high school and college?
We was all in college. We was all in our first semester of college.
Did you leave college once you started performing?
Yep, we took a leave of absence and been absent ever since.
What were your parents' reaction to taking a leave of absence to perform? Did they think you were making a big mistake?
No, they was mad. It was like, are you crazy? What are you doing? And, you know, even when they got a hint of me wanting to be a rapper as my career, as my job, you know, they was telling me stuff like, it's ridiculous. You better stay in school, and we're not paying all this money for you to go to St. John's for nothing. And as a matter of fact, when I went to record our first single, I didn't tell my parents because I knew they wouldn't have let me go. So they was outraged, you know?
How did they find out?
Well, I had to come tell them where I was at for the last 15 hours. You know, because I just left the house. It was a Sunday afternoon. I left the house about 1 o'clock, and I ain't come home in the morning until the next morning, like 5 a.m. in the morning.
Did you play them the record? Did they like it?
Yeah, I played them the record, and they didn't really like it till they heard it on the radio.
No, was that It's Like That?
Yeah, that was It's Like That.
Great, let's hear it. This is Run DMC's first recording. That's Run DMC, their first recording. And my guest is Daryl McDaniels, who's the DMC in Run DMC. Now, when you started performing, it was the big gold chain era.
Right. Actually, we started that.
Yeah, there's some great pictures of you with giant big gold chains.
Yeah. Like when we were saying Russell was a big part of that, Jay was always dressing like that. The way Run DMC dressed, Jay always dressed like that. So when Russell seen Jay, he said, "That's how you're going to dress." And that's when the gold chains came into play. Jay had a gold chain before he even thought of me in Run DMC. Jay wore chains like that when he was in high school.
Now, what would you think of those chains? I mean, especially looking back from the 90s at the early 80s with the big gold chains, they look so dated.
Yeah, right now it looks so funny. You know, I look at them and say, I can't believe we dress like that. I mean, what's the purpose of that? I mean, our parents didn't understand. What's the purpose of having a chain that big? You know what I'm saying?
I sure do.
And it's like, why? Why? You know, it looks so funny now, but back then it was like so cool.
What do you think it did for your image back then?
What it actually did showed that we had money, you know. It showed that we had the big gold chain and a fancy car and that we were truly the superstars of the neighborhood. You know, because if you got a big chain and the other guy don't, you must be doing something. And, you know, it also brought a bad image to us because people that didn't know Run DMC, before we had an album cover out, thought we was just drug dealers. Because most of the drug dealers was wearing chains like that and driving in big cars, even before the rappers made it big.
So were the chains solid gold?
Well, me and Run's was semi-solid, and Jay's was solid.
Daryl McDaniels is my guest, the DMC in Run DMC. And let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
DJ Run, I run, I'm mucking, run, I hit this. My name is Joe, I need a hook, I get a witness. Oh. And when I come, you're looking dumb, you say, who did this?
Did this.
Face, you're looking dumb on. Hum, could you hum on? Pizza dropping now, I'm wondering why and when and how. Drop it, come on, I got some on my tip. Get me up and going for the biggie.
Back with Daryl McDaniels, the DMC in Run DMC, which is probably the longest running rap group and one of the most popular over the years. You were teenagers when you started performing. How did you handle fame when it first hit you and you were still in your teens?
Oh, man, fame hit us so quick. I mean, it's like now we got this thing that we say that certain periods in our career we can't remember and we call it dazing. It was just like we was just in a daze. It was just like everything happened so quick, you know, the first record. Then we did the rap album, the first rap album to go gold because nobody thought rap was going to sell. Then right after that, we had the first video on MTV, and that was, like, really a precedent because the only black star that was actually playing on MTV was Michael Jackson. Then we got on in, and then when Rockbox, which was the video that got on MTV, went into heavy rotation, Russell and everybody down at the record company and at Rush Management was all excited. Y'all on MTV? And me and Runner J was like, what is MTV? Why are you guys so happy about this? And then the big tour, the Fresh tour, and we was going around selling out Madison Square Garden and all the big venues. It all happened so fast that, you know, it's like it smacked us upside the head. You know, the money, the fame, and fortune, it didn't go to our heads, but it smacked us upside our heads.
What was it like to suddenly have a lot of money?
Whoa, it was, man, it was, you know, me and Run always say, you know, when we was little, growing up and, you know, unless you was the star of the basketball team, the high school basketball team or the CYO basketball team or the neighborhood Hollis basketball team, none of the homeboys or the homegirls would give you any attention. And me and Run always said, all we want is one pair of Adidas, but our parents went and bought us Adidas because it was $40. It was like ridiculous to our parents, you know what I'm saying? They're middle class. So what's the point of, you know, we're going to buy you these $25 shoes, $20 shoes. If we could get them for $15, you're wearing those and you're going to be happy. And then when we became Run DMC, we could buy all the Adidas we wanted, all the Adidas suits we wanted. We could buy all the gold chains that we wanted. We could go buy the Cadillac that we wanted. And it was, like, just ridiculous. It was like God blessed us with everything that we wanted when we was, you know, growing up in elementary school. You know, he was at a point where you want to be like that guy who got every color pair of Adidas. And you want, you know, most, you know, you could tell the kids, a lot of the kids that was going to my school, they had jobs, you know what I'm saying? And, you know, we didn't have no jobs. The only job me and Ren ever had was pushing shopping carts for the supermarket, giving out circulars, and that was like twice a week. But most of our friends, they had 9-to-5s, and they was out there, you know, working and getting a lot of money. So every month, if something new came out, they could get it. So when we got money, we could get anything and everything. And as a matter of fact, we had stuff before it even came out because people started giving us stuff.
So you just started acquiring everything you could.
Yeah, exactly. Everything that we ever wanted, we was able to get.
Well, you know, you mentioned Adidas, and of course you have a very famous record called My Adidas. Before we hear it, why don't you say a little bit about coming up with this rap?
Well, it's real funny. Actually, Run's brother, Russell Simmons, came up with the idea. He, like, put it in the air. One day he said, y'all need to make a record about your Adidas and how y'all come from Hollis. And then the next day, you know, me and Run, we had the pen and pad out and we was writing this record. So we did the record even before we was approached by Adidas to, you know, for the promotional deal and stuff like that, for the endorsement. And the record came out, and then in 1986, you know, we was really the biggest thing going on in music. And an Adidas representative came to Madison Square Garden, and on that show, Adidas was the first record that we did. And before we did it, we said, whoever got on Adidas, take one shoe off and hold it up. And the whole Madison Square Garden held up the Adidas. And when the Adidas representative seen us, he was like, y'all guys got an endorsement. It's going to be big. You're going to be the first non-athletic group to get a major endorsement with an athletic company. And that was, like, really cool. But we made the record because we always just rapped about anything and everything. And we just gave a tribute to our Adidas saying, we are ready, sneakers for life, whatever. We don't care about Nike. We don't care about Bally. We don't care about nothing. Adidas are it forever.
Daryl McDaniels is the co-founder of Run DMC. He'll be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's My Adidas.
For tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime 1-888-NPR-NEWS.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, why Run DMC tried and rejected gangster rap. We'll continue our conversation with Run DMC's Daryl McDaniels. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews a new biography of Yates.
Back up before they get smacked up by the RUNDMC. queens getting wrecked, so act like you know.
They can kick it like I kick it when I kick this. Can I get a witness?
Yes, you can.
They can kick it like I kick it when I kick this. Can I get a witness?
Yes, you can.
They can kick it like I kick it when I kick this. Can I get a witness?
Yes, you can.
They can kick it like I kick it when I kick this. Can I get a witness?
Yes, you can.
As I spit this and get this out of my throat, I need a witness to get with this.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Daryl McDaniels, co-founder of Run DMC, rap's longest-running group. They've been recording a new record, their first in 3 years, which is supposed to come out later this year. When we left off, we were talking about Run DMC's impact on how their fans dressed, with their gold chains and Adidas sneakers. Now, how did it feel to see so many of your fans copying you? I mean, on the one hand, it can make you feel really, you know, proud and big and everything. On the other hand, it can really make you wonder about the independent thinking
of people. Actually, you know, my partner, Run, he was more excited about that. Like, wow, yo, look, we're the big, you know what I'm saying? And, you know, from a record-selling tip, it's, you know, it signified that, oh, wow, we're doing really great.
Right.
But then on another tip, you know, I was, like, kind of bugged. I liked it when rap was more... Everybody was more themselves, but we all could relate to the music. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And now, I mean, the same way that people did that when we had Adidas out is the same way people are doing, the fans are treating, you know, Tupac records and Biggie records and Snoop Dogg records. They're taking a lot of stuff these rappers are saying seriously. Like back then, if you had a pair of Adidas and you had an Adidas suit and a big old chain and a hat or maybe the glasses, you know, the gazelle glasses like I used to wear, you was down with rap and hip hop. Now you gotta have a gat, which is a gun, and you gotta smack your, you know, your hoe or your bitch, excuse my language, but you gotta smack her and you gotta have all these women and you gotta have a car and you gotta have this rough image, you know what I'm saying? You gotta drink champagne and smoke blunts and spend all this money. So the same thing, the same effect that we had on the fans back then is the same way rap is affecting the fans now, but it's not in a positive way. And, you know, a lot of the groups that's out now, like, it surprised me and it made me feel good when Martin Lawrence, who's a comedian, Chris Rock, who's a comedian, you know, at the two times that I met them, they came up to me and said, D, because of Run DMC, I am what I am today. So that's good because they didn't want to be a rapper like DMC and dress like me, but we inspired them to be what they wanted to be. They looked at us and said, I can do what I want to be. And it really hit me when Boyz II Men at the Grammys, Boyz II Men came up to me and said, we're doing this because of y'all. You know what I'm saying? I'm like, wow. You know, that's the type of effect mm-hmm. I want to have. I don't mm-hmm. want everybody trying to be Run DMC. You know, and it's bad if everybody's trying to be Tupac or everybody's trying to be Biggie. What these guys do represent is out of the hood, out of poverty or out of crime or out of a single parent home or coming out of jail, you can be something. And that's what's good to represent. But you don't got to be the same gun toting, reefer smoking, champagne drinking person as this rapper is. And that's confusing to the parents because the parents get scared. Okay, my son likes Tupac, but this is what Tupac did last week. I don't want my son to do that.
Was there ever any pressure on you from producers or record companies to harden your image, to make it more hardcore?
No, but we felt pressure on ourselves. In 1990, we made an album called Back From Hell. And on his Back From Hell album, it was like the first album we ever really used profanity. And it was like the first album we ever really came at everybody else in the industry. It was, you know, the first album where we kind of degraded women. You know, we didn't really talk bad like most records did, but we started talking. We started, you know, straying that way. And that was like one of our worst albums. So we learned a big lesson from that. I mean, that album was like a flop for Run DMC and only sold maybe 250,000 copies. That was the year everybody was saying Run DMC was over. You know what I'm saying? Because we strayed from what we was really about. Even though we were still doing live shows, we made this album, which was trying to go with the flow of the times.
Mm-hmm.
When keeping it real is being real to yourself and staying who you are.
Now, I know that you're a Christian. Was there like a change in your life where you were born again?
Right around that time. I mean, you know, the records wasn't selling. Everybody was saying we was over. Run was smoking a lot of reefer. I was drinking a lot of beer. Things wasn't well within the group. You know, people was like saying, yo, Run DMC is over. You know, their time is over. And that was like really a down time. And, you know, with anybody, when it's time to, when you are down and out on your deathbed, I don't care who you are, you're going to scream out to God, you know, and he's going to answer, and it's up for you to answer his calling. And, you know, basically, it was nowhere else we could turn but to God. You know, God help us. You know, and we was like, yo, we're very thankful for everything that happened and this and that. And if only we could, you know, just get back to what we was all about. But we had to make that adjustment in our minds ourselves. You know what I'm saying? But it was like really a down time. I mean, the women, it was like the worst time for Run DMC of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. You know, all that stuff that you think, when I'm not going to go that way, I'm not going to happen to us. And it was like really a bad time for us.
And so when you were born again, how did that change your music and your lifestyle?
Well, it cleaned up our lives. We stopped smoking reefer, stopped drinking beer, stopped sleeping with every groupie that you know, and stopped running around with the drug dealers in the wrong crowd. And, you know, that's why we named the record Down with the King, because we said, wow, we're the only rap group that's been here for, at the time we was out for 10 years. We're the only rap group that's been together for 10 years. Everybody else in the business broke up, and we realized that we had a marriage here. And we was like, yo, this is really like a marriage because we're still here. Even though our popularity was down, people still gave us respect. So we was like, all right, we're going to dedicate one of these records on this album to God. And that record became the single, and that single became the name of the album.
Down with the King.
Down with the King.
Why don't we hear that?
Okay.
I'm taking the tours, I'm wrecking the land. I keep it hardcore because it's dope, man. These are the roughest, toughest words I ever wrote down. Not meant for a hole like a slow jam. Check it. Sucker MCs could never swing with D because of all the things that I bring with me. Only G.O.D. could be a king to me. And if the G.O.D. be in me, then a king I be. The microphone is granted when it's handed to me. I was planted on this planet and I plan to MC. The MC fiends only seem to agree that I rock of the world and the society. I rage on the stages with a tuna verse. I give praises from these pages to the universe. My voice is raw, my lyrics is law. I keep it hardcore like you never saw. You wanna be. You wanna be.
That's Run DMC. We'll talk more with co-founder Daryl McDaniels after a break. This is Fresh Air.
When I wake up, people take up mostly all of my time. Singing, folks keep ringing, cause I make up a rhyme. I'm not bragging, people nagging, cause they think I'm a...
Back with Daryl McDaniels, co-founder of Run DMC. The group has been together, well, you've been recording since, what, 1982?
Yeah.
And started performing even before that.
Yeah.
Extraordinarily long, I mean, for any group, but particularly, I think, in the world of rap.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
How do you think you managed to stay together that long?
Wow, that's really a good question. The reason why we stayed together that long, because we never let the fortune and fame take away from the true art form of what rapping and MCing means to us. Meaning that if we never made it as Run DMC, and Run, when he was going to college, he was studying mortuary science, I was studying business management, but then I would have had to change because I wanted to go into architecture, and Jay was studying business management. So even if we had wife and kids working 9-to-5s with families, on the weekends, on holidays, on days off. We're going to get together in the park at Jay's birthday party, at our son's birthday party, and we're going to DJ and rap and scratch. So we never lost that desire of, we never let the rap become a thing as, we got to get money with this thing. We always like really doing it. We always like really doing a live show. And we always like, making fun lyrics or making lyrics that mean something. We never let the fortune take away from the art form or the meaning of, you know, the culture of hip-hop, what hip-hop really stands for.
One of the things that you've done in some of your records is take sample things from rock and heavy metal. Mm-hmm. One of your most famous records, Walk This Way, uses the famous Aerosmith recording on it. And I'm wondering if you feel like that exposed you to audiences that rap records might not have otherwise reached.
Most definitely, it exposed us to, you know, although at the same time, we was already on MTV. But the reason why we made a lot of rock records is because before rap records was made, we used to have to find things to rap over. And rock and roll had a lot of drum breaks and a lot of drum beats. And rock and roll had a lot of loud guitars. And rap was like an aggressive art form, and it was hard. So we had to find rock records. We couldn't rap over violins and flutes and soft stuff. We needed something hard. And we wanted to make a record using the Aerosmith beat. But Rick Rubin, who was our producer at the time, he was an Aerosmith fan back when it was large. He was like, oh, you don't know whose record that is you're rapping over? And they're the Aerosmith, and they was big when I was younger, and this and that. Hey, you know what y'all should do? Y'all should do their record over. Now, me and Run was real mad because all we wanted to do was say our rhymes over that beat. Rick Rubin wanted us to learn Steven Tyler's lyrics. And we was like, oh, Rick, you're going to ruin our career and this and that. That's not going to work. You know, we're barely getting over by rapping, you know, doing our own lyrics over rock. Now you want us to do a cover of a rock song? But we did it and it worked. And it opened up us to a whole wider audience.
A lot of rap groups really brag about their neighborhood, often bragging about how tough it is.
Yeah.
What was your neighborhood like, Hollis, Queens?
Hollis, Queens was, it was a middle-class, hard-working neighborhood. It had a lot of educated people there, but you also had, you know, violence and drugs and prostitution and murder and rape and robbery right on the corner. You know, it's just good that we came from good families who made sure we went to school, didn't play hooky, or run with the wrong crowd. So you had good and bad going on at the same time, which is true for every neighborhood. But some places have more poverty than other places, and people tend to let their surroundings suppress them. It was like we always, regardless of what going on, if we didn't have a dollar in our pocket or if we did have the dollar in our pocket, we were still happy. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Now, did you ever feel like you had to cover up the fact that your neighborhood was pretty middle class and that your parents wouldn't let you play hooky?
Nah, it was no way we could hide it because that was something the reporters made known to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they thought it was a big thing. All right, here you got this rap group making all this money, running around talking about their cars and, you know, how good they are. And, you know, they're selling a lot of records. And, you know, it was a thing where rap was supposed to be only done by, you know, people from the ghetto,
mm-hmm,
you know what I'm saying? Because,
mm-hmm,
you know, Grandmaster Flash and them, they came from the heart of the Bronx. And Afrika Bambaataa, they was from Bronx and Manhattan. They was from the ghetto, you know what I'm saying? Apartment buildings and broken glass everywhere. People was a subway. We came from Hollis, Queens, where you got separate houses, grads, backyards, cookout, Catholic school, and all this other stuff going on. But, you know, we wanted people to know, you know, my mother and father, Jay's mother and father, runs by hard-working, educated people. But then you had the people that, you know, lived in the middle of the block, you know, they had to rob and steal for the next meal. But a lot of the press wanted to emphasize, I guess they wanted to let the world know that these guys are fronting. They might look tough and they might talk tough on their record, but they're middle-class, Catholic school, nice guys.
Keeping it real is a big expression.
Big.
In the rap world. And I wonder what that means to you, given that so much of rap music has just kind of hardened into formula.
Yeah, it
and
did.
That there's so much copying and mimicry.
Yes, oh, yeah. Wow. I mean, and it's ridiculous. But Wyclef, Wyclef Jean from the Fugees said the most interesting thing about that. He said he went over to Japan, and a Japanese guy greeted him. And, you know, he was dressed like, you know, your basic American hip-hopper hat, you know, baggy pants, sneakers, you know, Tommy Hilfiger or some Gap stuff or, you know, whatever's the hip clothes to wear for that month. And he came up to Wyclef and he said, "Wyclef, Fuji, keep it real." And Wyclef said he looked at this Japanese guy and said he hasn't the slightest idea what this phrase means. He's just saying it because he see a lot of other rappers say it. So that told Wyclef that if you're sitting home and you're from the South and you got Master Pimp, I'm just making up a name. Master Pimp is his new record is hot and he just sold 3 million records and he got the hottest video. And a kid is looking at that. To him, that's keeping it real. Being a pimp, rapping about violence and sex and drugs and rapping about girls and money and cars. Keeping it real is keeping reality alive. You know what I'm saying? Keeping it real means dealing with the positive and the negative, not trying to capitalize off the negative. Keeping it real is doing what you want to do. You know what I'm saying? A lot of rappers now want to copy and emulate everybody. You know what I'm saying? Do what you made up in your shower. Do what you had a dream about last night. Because that's the only way it's going to change. Right now, rap is so monotonous, I can't even look at rap. I don't even listen to rap radio now.
Really? What do you listen to?
Whoa, I listen to Joan Osborne and Sheryl Crow and Jewel and Counting Crows. Because when I listen to their music and... And, you know, they're dealing with their people. They're dealing with humanity. Problems ranging from politics to love relationships. And that's what rap started out as. You know what I'm saying? To give you an example, I was talking to somebody who works at one of the major rap labels. And she was all hyped about this new artist coming out. And they're going to do this. And the record's going to be big. And I said, what are they talking about? And it looked like she got so sad because she looked at me and said, "Guns and drugs." And it was like, again? You know what I'm saying? Back in the 80s, you had Run DMC doing our thing. You had LL Cool J talking about "I Need Love." And then you had Big Daddy Kane. You had Eric B. and Rakim. You had the Fat Boys who were like comic relief. You know what I'm saying? It was so versatile. Then you had De La Soul come out, Tribe Called Quest. Now all you got is Rough Crew Killer, Pimp Daddy Big, Drug Dealer Sam, Murderer Rapist, and it's ridiculous. You know what I'm saying? And so now for a positive brother or somebody with just some political insight or somebody just want to be creative and talk about sunshine and the beach and good things, when they go to these record companies, oh, well, you're not what we're looking for at this time because they only want what sells. And right now, the violence and the negative stuff is selling.
I don't know if you or any of the other members of Run DMC have children.
Yes, we do. I have a 2-year-old son. Run has 5 kids, ranging from 6 months to 12. And Jam Master Jay has 3 kids, ranging from 1 year to 10, I think.
So what do you all tell the children who are old enough to care about gangster rap?
Wow, it's like really scary because you can't hide it from them because when they go to school and when they go out in the street, they're going to hear it anyway.
Well, if they follow your careers, they're going to notice it too.
Right, that's true too. So, I mean, I guess, you know, most of our kids respect us because we're still doing it. So they know that the thing that we're doing is the thing that's it because we get so much props from everybody else in the business. Although, you know, I could... Even my 2-year-old son, when he hears Wu-Tang Clan and the guy that rapped the "Old Dirty Bastard," he start bobbing his head and doing his lyrics. You know what I'm saying? Or, so, you know, there's a lot of kids out there. You know, most of the kids, you know, 14 and 15 know everything Tupac ever said.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? F the police and bitch, give me my money. And they know these lyrics and they saying these lyrics. You know what I'm saying? And it's just bad because the hypnotic thing about it is, you know, most of the kids think in order to be a rapper now, these are things you got to talk about. When back in the 80s, you could talk about anything and not be scared of being called a sucker or soft or a sellout or you ain't keeping it real. It's got to be about the hood. You know what I'm saying? It's got to be about the hood. And that's the mentality the kids have now. But a lot of the kids all actually, you know, are really looking for something different. It's just that nobody's the record companies is not taking that step, and the rappers themselves are not taking that step to do that next thing.
Are you still wearing Adidas?
Yes. I'm sitting here with Adidas on from head to toe. And we're always wearing Adidas.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. We're out of time. I wish we weren't, but we got to go.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks a lot for talking with us. I really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure.
Daryl McDaniels is the co-founder of Run DMC. They're recording their first album in 3 years. Here's Walk This Way. Coming up, a new biography of Yeats. This is Fresh Air. For many literary scholars as well as readers, W.B. Yeats is the greatest poet of the century. And for more than 50 years, Richard Ellman's W.B. Yeats, The Man and the Masks has been the definitive biography of the poet. Now there's a contender for that honor. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says that for initiates who don't know much about Yeats, Ellman's biography is still the ticket. But for devotees who want to know how Yeats became Yeats, R.F. Foster's W.B. Yeats, A Life is the new standard.
R.F. Foster begins his biography of W.B. Yeats with a product differentiation claim. Most biographical studies of Yeats, says Foster, are principally about what he wrote. This one is principally about what he did. A historian rather than a literary critic, Foster commits himself to recording the day-by-dayness of Yeats's first 49 years. What his magnificent but dauntingly detailed biography chiefly reveals to us is that day by day, Yeats was wallowing in mystical mumbo-jumbo. From the time he left school at 19, Yeats immersed himself in the study of the occult. He belonged to secret organizations and believed in fairies, reincarnation, automatic writing, seances, and a coming Celtic millennium. True, during his formative years, Yeats was also reading Blake and Nietzsche, but the work of those eccentric geniuses was outweighed by that of the merely eccentric. That some of the most miraculous poems of the 20th century emerged from this intellectual sludge gives the lie to the you-are-what-you-read nutritional model of learning. Foster has rightly dubbed his biography a thick history of Yeats's life. It's also a smoothly written one that's politically as well as psychologically astute. Foster's authoritative grasp of Irish history illuminates the wobbly foundations upon which the House of Yeats rested. Yeats, who was born in 1865 into a Bohemian artist household, was descended from Irish Protestant gentry whose world was threatened by the late 19th century Home Rule movement. The adult Yeats embraced moderate nationalism, but, says Foster, Yeats would always emend his presentation of Irish politics depending on the sympathy of his audience. Indeed, when that audience included the radical separatist Maud Gunn, Yeats spouted off like a Gaelic Che Guevara to try to win her heart. Yeats met the red-headed Amazon who would inspire some of his greatest poetry in January of 1889, the same month his first book of poetry, The Wanderings of Ossian, was published to rave reviews. Gunn was 18 months younger than Yeats, but as Foster shows, much more sexually experienced. For many years, the virginal Yeats knew nothing about Gunn's erotic entanglements and tirelessly proposed marriage to her. Though he was putty in Gunn's hands, Yeats could be quite obstreperous with other folks. Foster quotes hordes of people who found the poet arrogant, pedantic, and a wee bit of a bore. One friend, Thomas Sturge Moore, destroys the fantasy that it would have been heavenly to hear Yeats read aloud. Describing an evening spent listening to Yeats recite poems, Moore wrote, "Yeats read them abominably as usual, so that it was very difficult to hear the last word of each wretch of his parson's caw." It was in the arena of the theater, however, that Yeats incurred his most impassioned critics. In the opinion of one wag, Mr. Yeats had done more than anybody else to create an Irish theater, and he had also done more than anybody else to prevent anyone from going there. Foster chronicles the feuds and fundraising schemes that compose the history of what would become the Abbey Theatre. He also brings to life Yeats's relationship with the other towering female figure in his life and his partner in the Abbey Theatre, Lady Augusta Gregory. Their friendship spanned nearly 40 years and was the antidote to the black magic bond with Gunn. Foster leaves Yeats in 1914, plagued by a sense of being prematurely washed up. In a forgivable plug for Volume 2 of his biography, Foster notes that, ironically, the best was yet to come for Yeats. His finest poetry, marriage, fatherhood, political revolution, even greater fame, and yes, still more spectacular supernatural revelations. Foster's relentless rendering of Yeats will doubtless result in another splendid book, but all of Foster's heroic labors cannot quite clarify the relationship between this peculiarly busy man and his surpassing genius. Still, the yolk and the white of the one shell inseparable, the dancer and the dance unknowable.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed W.B. Yeats' A Life by R.F. Foster. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Roberta Shirock. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, and Dorothy Farabee, with Monique Nazareth and Alan Tu, who also directed today's show. Research assistance from Sarah Scherer. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the difficulties of balancing work and home life. We talk with Arlie Hochschild, author of a new book which finds that for many busy parents, home is becoming more like work, while the office is becoming a refuge from the pressures of family life. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.